Dead Podcast. Wanna know what's happening to Steve? This Dead Podcast. Don't you know it's Grierson and Leech? Grierson and Leech. Grierson and Leech. Don't you know it's Grierson and Leech?
Hi, I'm Tim Grierson.
And hi, I'm Will Leech, and this is the Grierson Leech Podcast, episode 160. I come to you live from Georgia, as usual. Grierson comes to us from the great Midwest, Columbia, Missouri, home of the True False Film Festival, where you are again this year. What number film festival, True False Film Festival, is this for you this year?
Amazingly, this is my seventh.
That's amazing.
I can't believe it's been, the time has sort of rushed by, but yeah, this is my seventh. It's one of my favorite film festivals. I'm very happy to be back. It's Sunday as we're recording this. There's a fresh layer of snow outside this morning when I woke up this morning. So I'm not shoveling my sidewalk, though, or my driveway, so I'm thrilled.
You're not hitting the slopes? That's a different film festival. That's a different film
Wait,
festival.
Hold on. Swoosh.
Yes,
where's, there we go.
Where's the dog in sunglasses and the hot chicks? In the
I had to find my ski poles there for a second. Now I have them on.
True Falls seems to be getting a little bit bigger every year. Shout out to Matt Pitzer, city councilman, future mayor of Columbia, Missouri, and fellow member, like Tim Grierson, of my wedding party. Shout out to Matt Pitzer. But as True Falls gets bigger every year, is it still cool? Like, is it still fun? Has it gotten too big for its britches?
Well, in a different context, I was joking about how all of us, no matter what age you are listening, that you will always go to things that people will tell you were better before you went to them. and True False may be the only situation like that in my life. And it's absolutely still fabulous now. It's still great. But I'm looking forward to someday, somewhere in the future, where I'll get to be one of the obnoxious people who's like, yeah, you know, back in the aughts, it was really amazing. But no, the festival is still the same size it is. It's always been, it's like a 3.5-day festival, still about the same amount of movies, basically the same programmers who started from the very beginning, about 15 years ago or whatever. So it really does. The bloom is not off the rose. It still very much feels like the festival I attended 7 years ago, and it still feels special. So, yeah, it's still pretty great.
All right. Well, one thing I want to ask about, because there's just so many movies, and I don't want to make you go down the rabbit hole on it, but the one movie I've heard a lot about is Finding Francis. And from what I understand, I have to confess, I'm one of those people that always meant to get around to watch Nathan For You, but never actually did. But that's okay, because there is the internet. There are all sorts of ways I have the opportunity to watch it. However, it seems like this is a movie based off an episode, or is it the actual episode? I've been a little confused. Don't give away any of the episodes or the movie's secrets, but is it an old episode, or is it a movie? What is it?
Yes, for people who are fans of Nathan For You, you know what the Finding Francis episode is. It was the finale. Was it the finale? It was one of the episodes of this most recent season. Most episodes are half an hour long. That's the format of the show. But for Finding Francis, Nathan Fielder essentially told Comedy Central, I think this one's going to be a little bit longer. And they said, oh, how long do you think it's going to be? And he said, oh, I think it's going to be a two-hour episode. And they basically said, that's fine. You can do that. And this was, for people who don't watch Nathan For You, it was the episode that they were told, you have to see this episode. It was the episode that Errol Morris wrote about very favorably in The New Yorker, talking about it being, I forget if he called it like the documentary of the year or the film of the year when it aired in 2017. But he thought it was basically a masterpiece, and it's kind of been hailed as one of like the great pieces of nonfiction filmmaking of the last few years. It played here at True False. There was one screening that I attended because I had seen it before, and I was sort of curious to see how it would play in one of the big theaters here in Columbia, Missouri. And I was mostly with people who had never seen the show or the episode. And for people who are listening who know what happens in Finding Francis, it is an absolute treat to watch that film, let's just call it, with a bunch of people who don't know what they're getting themselves into and don't even necessarily know what the concept of Nathan For You is. I always liked the episode. It played great in a big house. It plays well with a big audience. It's one of my two real like highlights of this festival. Nathan Fielder came, introed the film, did a Q&A afterwards, and also showed some clips that were cut out of the Finding Francis episode. But yeah, it was really, I said, because I had seen it, I thought, well, do I need to see this again? And I'm so glad I went. It's one of my favorite things I've seen this year at the festival.
But it's just the episode. It's not anything expanded. It's just the original.
No, there's conversation about being, quote, the theatrical cut. I actually, funny enough, have the original still on my DVR at home. And so I may actually like kind of skim through it to see if there's anything. It felt like the same length as it aired on the show on Comedy Central. So it is essentially what they aired.
Okay, so my last question on this, because we have a lot of movies to get to. I've never watched Nathan For You, but I'm sure I've heard it's really great. Would it be a mistake for me, because this is the last episode, there's four seasons, this is the final episode of season four. Can I just watch it? Like, do I need to like a background on Nathan? I know generally what he does, but like, do I need to, if I just downloaded it right now, you can get it from iTunes right now, or probably other streaming things. I just buy things off iTunes because I still think it's 2003. But if I want to, I can watch it and I will not be confused.
I would say that you probably could. There are like, you know, there's sort of like a couple other classic episodes like Dumb Starbucks.
Yeah, but your audience watched it without necessarily even knowing anything about it, and it went over great.
It went over great. I mean, they actually asked beforehand, how many people have actually never seen Nathan For You? And there were a huge amount of hands. It was at the Missouri Theater, one of the biggest theaters here in Columbia. There were a lot of hands up, and there were many hands around me that went up, and people seemed to enjoy it. So if you're generally aware of Nathan Fielder and generally aware of Nathan For You, you'll be fine. What is interesting is that in certain ways, this episode is different tonally than some of the other ones. So as a compare contrast, it's kind of interesting. But that being said, I think you can watch it on its own and get a sufficient amount out of it.
All right. So I'm going to do that. I'm going to do that, Grayson. Maybe we'll talk about that a little later. I also want to talk to you at some point about documentary now, but we don't have time for that because we got an episode to get into. So this is Grayson's Podcast. Episode 160. Remind you, as always, follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Email us, GriersonLeach@gmail.com. We're on Instagram and Facebook, kind of. You can...
It's a process.
You can check us out. Check out our website, GriersonLeach.com. Go to GriersonLeach.com/RSVP to see a list of every single movie we've talked about on this here podcast. Opening songs by Dylan Mayer. On Cuthbert Avenue, find it on Bandcamp, SoundCloud, Clearly Songs, My Friend Mary. Short songs on Melancholy Longings Facebook page, My Friend Mary. Grisha, I think we have a t-shirt, right? Where do people get the t-shirt?
That's cottonbureau.com.
Cottonbureau.com. Type in Grierson Leach. Get yourself a t-shirt. Get yourself borked. Subscribe to us on Google Play, Stitcher, Overcast, SoundCloud, Spotify, iHeartRadio. But the best way to find every new podcast the second that it goes up is subscribe to us on iTunes/Apple Podcasts. And if you do, please give us a review in our review section where the reviews go, and then listen to the movie you like.
where do I put my review? I don't know.
Just people are just like punching their computer screen. What's wrong with this thing? Where does the review go? If you give us a review, we will and give us the name of a movie you'd like us to discuss. We will discuss it in our reboot section. This week we have three new movies, none of which our reboots, because we got lots of stuff to get to, Grierson. And also, you're at the True False, so we got to get you out of there so you can go to some of those screenings. You see?
Yes. I have to ski to... Wait, let me grab my poles. Hold on a second.
Don't grab... Grierson, that's gross. That's gross.
Get your mind out of the gutter.
So anyway, Grierson, so we got three movies to talk about. Now, we remind you... Last week.
Yes, because I insisted.
Yes. And also, another thing we're not getting into yet is Steven Spielberg's thing about Netflix. Well, maybe we'll talk about that next week. We don't have time to talk
I'm
about
not read. I haven't read that yet. I don't want to read it. My head hurts just thinking about it. I don't want to know.
It's a whole thing. So you know it's a bit, yeah, it's a whole deal. So be ready for that.
Just real fast, let's review the two things that Steven Spielberg has been in the news for in the last 2 weeks. Number one, big fan of Green Book. Number two, bitching about theatrical windows and Netflix and
listen. And, I'm more philosophically. I'm not really with him on either one, but I'm more philosophically with him on the second one.
I'm just saying he's had a lot of great yes. Mr. Spielberg, can you just make another movie right now?
Yeah. And not, yes. Yeah. Also, the children on his porch. All right, because he goes the kids off his porch and off his lawn. You see, because he's old, you get it. All right, Garrison. So anyway, we're going to talk about three movies. But as we established last week, the first one is not officially a movie. Under this definition, because it did not play in theatrical release, it is an HBO movie, but I felt it was important to talk about. I think everyone is talking about it. It feels like a movie we should discuss. It was a movie that you saw at Sundance, so you saw it in a theatrical environment. So I think it's okay for discussing, but just so you know, this is, to remind, not eligible for Dorkfest. This is not eligible for Oscars. This is not eligible for to be on any top 10 list. It is not officially a movie in that regard. I'm so glad we're discussing it because I have a lot to discuss about it, but it does not count officially as a movie. And so this is kind of us getting our Spielberg on a little bit. Movie, not a movie. Movie, not a movie.
Right. So please, we love you listeners, but please don't ask us to review Russian Doll or, yes, you know, things like that. Those are even more not movies, so we are definitely not reviewing those.
Everybody in Russian Doll is mean. That's my review of Russian Doll. They're so mean.
I still have to watch the last episode. It's a treat for me and my wife when we get back
to... Don't you think they're all a little mean? I don't mean to be like an old Midwestern guy, but they're all just kind of mean.
Listen, you live in the, you know, God's country or whatever you call Athens, Georgia. You don't know what it's like in the big city anymore, man. This is, it's cutthroat out there in New York City.
There were like a ton of I lived in New York City for 13 years. People are nice.
Let me tell you how the big city is. Let me tell you how the big city is. Well, you're a farmer out there, whatever you're doing. In the big city, life is tough. You're always repeating things. Harry Nilsson is playing. That's, by the way, one of the best parts, apparently, of the New York and Russian Dolls that Harry Nilsson is playing all the time. But wait, we're not here to review.
Yes, I'm trying
Russian
to
Doll. Well,
I'm just saying that people are not. From my experience, people in New York are a lot nicer than they are in that movie. But maybe in that show, maybe that's just me. Anyway, speaking of things that are not nice, transitioning to our first new movie this week. Remember, not an official theatrical release, but we are certainly discussing because there's a lot to discuss. Our first movie is Leaving Neverland.
Everybody wanted to meet Michael or be with Michael. And then he likes you.
I was 7 years old. Michael asked, do you and the family want to come to Neverland?
We drive in and forget about all your problems. You were in Neverland. It was a fantasy.
Leaving Neverland is directed by Dan Reed, and it features... It's 4 hours, so be ready. There's an intermission, I guess a stop, a part two, if you will. When you saw this in Sundance, there was a part two. It was split, right? You didn't watch it straight. It was still split when you saw it in Sundance?
We saw the first part. There was a 15-minute bathroom break, and then we saw part two.
Okay. It seems like a long bathroom break. I guess there's probably lots of people. It's not just you.
You're in a movie theater. Yeah. You need time for humans to...
Yeah, to get through the line.
Don't judge people's bladder, Jesus.
Yeah. Anyway, Leaving Neverland is 4 hours in two parts. It played on HBO this weekend. It's on HBO Go now if you want to watch it. And it basically tells the story of Wade Robson and Jimmy Safechuck. They are two. Wade was Australian. He was discovered, and he was discovered as a obsessive Michael Jackson dancer when he was a boy. He was brought on stage, as a time where Michael Jackson was bringing kids on stage. We'll get into that in a second. Where Wade Robson was a particularly skilled Michael Jackson impersonator, so they became friends. Jimmy Safechuck, alternately, was in Los Angeles. He was a young actor. He was in the famous Pepsi video where he is surprised to see he goes and sees all of Michael Jackson's stuff and then is surprised by Michael Jackson himself. He ends up kind of separately also becoming Michael Jackson's best friend. And basically what we kind of learn, as we did not know already, but certainly get in very, very detailed fashion, is all of those times when you were young and you're like, wow, you know, Michael Jackson makes incredible music. This guy is one of the really great kind of music artists of our time. It's kind of strange that he just always has kids around and there's always children around. And his best friends are always a kid. And you know, the way this was always kind of justified, the way we would justify it to ourselves was because of his abusive father, he was robbed of his childhood and they're trying to relive his childhood. Well, leaving Neverland makes a, I would argue, overwhelmingly compelling case that, in fact, this was a ritualistic pedophile. This was a ritualistic guy who was assaulting these kids and several kids, not just Wade and Jimmy. And it's strange because when I talk about it, I make it sound, it's hard, right? Like it's leaving Neverland. It's about Michael Jackson, one of the most famous people really of the last 100 years, if you take a step back from it. I make it sound like it's about Michael Jackson. And in a certain way, it is about Michael Jackson, obviously. But one of the things that Dan Reed does in this, I think to pretty powerful effect, it is officially a documentary, but what it really is, I feel like it almost is bearing witness to what Wade and Jimmy have to say. The movie goes, there's been some criticism of the movie for not doing like a both sides or like a traditional journalistic sort of documentary. On one hand, I guess that is true. On the other hand, that's not what this is about. This is about bearing witness to what two boys went through, and then I guess more in the second half, how it affected them in their adult lives and how they kind of dealt with it and how their families dealt with it. And to me, that is, while I'm sure that gives fodder to the Jackson family and those kind of deluded defenders who will just kind of stick with him to the very end, I think it makes for a much more powerful movie because you really just get into the depths of what these kids went through and then how they tried to recover from it. One of the more powerful things, this is an incredibly difficult sit, and I didn't see, did you see the R. Kelly documentary, Christian?
I have not yet. No.
Yeah, I've not either. I have a lot of people talk to me about the R. Kelly documentary, about how difficult of a sin it is. I'm sure that's true. This is as difficult a sit as I can kind of remember, because the movie goes into very specific detail, and not just specific detail in the physical sense, though it certainly does that, but really how Jackson groomed these kids and controlled these kids. It is not unlike any other, I mean, in addition to the fact that they're children, it's not unlike any other sort of abusive relationship. The family is isolated. The kids are told that Michael's the only one that can help you. He's the only one on your side. Your life will be destroyed if you tell anyone about this. One of the things that really is effective about the movie's length is you're really able to go all the way and understand what happened to these kids and why it happened and how it happened. And that in a way that is, again, convincing to say the least, but also makes it triply effective because you see how this happens and you see how it happened with the kids. You see how it happened with the families. One of the things that's really upsetting, particularly in the second half, is it's made clear that, you know, these kids loved Michael. They you know, their whole kind of adult lives were warped by this idea, and it's only kind of late in life as they kind of have started families of their own where this has really been able to they've been able to kind of process it at all, and even then kind of only entirely. It is as a documentary, I don't know if it's the most visually inventive. This is definitely a film where drone shots do a lot of work. I would be curious to see if this movie had come out 7 years earlier, how Dan Reed would transition between interview scenes, because it's basically just drone shots and this. But it kind of sets to that mood, right? It kind of puts you in that kind of otherworldly watching this this dispassionate observer. And it's not dispassionate observer, but removed observer kind of watching this entire story. We can get into this in a little bit, but For a while on this podcast, we've talked about really when kind of these stories first started popping up in the last 2 years about how you separate the art from the artist and how you can admire the art while the person not being a good person. And I've struggled with it, and I think I've evolved on it, and I've come better on it. This is, I would argue, the most compelling case. I don't know how we're going to listen to Michael Jackson songs after this. Like, I really don't. And as many people have pointed out, including Wesley Morris in a fantastic piece about this in the New York Times, about how it's not just a matter of being like, okay, I guess I won't listen to Remember the Time anymore. Michael Jackson influence is everywhere and is everywhere in music right now. So it's not like you can somehow surgically remove him from the conversation. But the idea of listening to his music now and knowing that not just whether or not you're making an active judgment of it by listening to it now, but what he was able to get away with essentially in plain sight because of that music is pretty staggering. And I know the culture has changed a lot. And I know that like the way that we treated superstars in the 80s and early 90s is different than the way we treat them now for better and sometimes even worse. But this is not just an argument against Michael Jackson and not just a story of these kids, but just an argument of just recognizing what's in front of your goddamn face. And that was one of the things that really affected me watching it. Leaving Neverland, we've successfully called it Leaving Neverland so far, rather than calling it Finding Neverland. Leaving Neverland is, I wouldn't say it is the most inventive documentary I've ever seen. I don't think it ever needs to be. I think it is exactly what it needs to be. It is incredibly powerful and pretty regularly devastating.
Yeah, it is. And it only gets more devastating as it goes along. You know, even when I saw it at Sundance, there were conversations about, yeah, I mean, it's the most TV thing about it is that the, you know, 2 hours commercial, you know, 2 hours and then another 2 hours. And it feels in certain ways like it's made for television. Not unlike OJ Made in America in a certain way, where there is still sort of a formula that the film is following. And after a while, I just didn't care anymore. I mean, there's a lot of drone shots in this. I mean, the joke I made at Sundance is like between this and the story of film, I don't ever need to see a drone shot of Los Angeles again because both films cover it so well. But I have to say one of the things that's so important about the movie's length is that you need the time to understand just how easily they were, both families, were very much seduced by Michael Jackson. I agree with everything that you said. Two things I want to kind of add to in terms of what I think is so great about this movie. The first is that the movie is remarkably compassionate and sympathetic to the question that a lot of people I think are going to ask when they watch the movie, which is where the hell were the parents? How come they didn't know better? I think that he does exceptionally good work with both of these guys' moms, because the moms are crucial, I think, in this movie. And you need to spend time with them, too, because it's not just Robson and Safechuck who are interviewed in this movie. These people's significant others, these people's families, especially their moms, are on camera in separate interviews as well. And you need to, and I think the movie does a really great job of this, you need to go back to the late 80s and the early 90s when this is happening to understand exactly why it's such a big deal for these families that Michael Jackson thinks their boy is special and why it's like a life-changing moment and why nobody thinks what now seems obvious. Why didn't these people know better? It's weird that he was hanging out with these kids all the time. I think the movie does a really compelling job in their own voices explaining the mindset. You do not walk away from this movie thinking that these people are dumb or suckers. And I think that is a crucial element in Leaving Neverland. You need the time to understand that because then when the really tough stuff starts happening and you start hearing the stories of what, I guess for legal purposes, we should say allegedly did or reportedly did, the specificity of the stories are absolutely just crushing. I was on the radio talking about this movie at Sundance, and I said, you know, if even let's be completely cynical about this and think that these people are not, that they're lying or they're making up these stories, even if only 50% of what these two guys talk about is accurate, that's damning enough. There is so much in here, and the way that they tell the stories and the fact that they did, these two guys did not know each other as boys. They had a separate relationship with Michael Jackson, and they're interviewed separately in the movie. There's enough interesting overlap between their two stories where you think, oh God, this was a pattern. This was a thing that Michael Jackson did, not just to these two guys. He must have done this to other people as well, because it was a system that seemed to work and he knew how to do it. And it's really, really just shocking. And the other thing I think is also really interesting, and this is not a spoiler, I don't think. When we were going to see the movie at Sundance, that was the first time anybody had seen the movie, I think there was a natural inclination, and people who are listening to this podcast may also have this inclination, of assuming that the 4 hours ends with Michael Jackson dying. That is not where the movie ends. He actually dies around the three-hour mark. And this gets to the other thing I think is really incredible about this film, which is that this is about two families that were destroyed. And that's the story that Dan Reed is actually telling. I agree with you 100%. Well, that this is actually, while Michael Jackson is a crucial component of it and a major villain in this movie, the movie is actually about the families. It is about what happens to this family, these families, what happens to these two guys, and how they try and sort of pick up the pieces. I almost don't want to get into too much of that because I think the discovery for an audience of learning what Safechuck and Robson went through in their later years and like that is why you invest the time. Because when it gets to where it gets to, you have spent enough time with these guys that you have understood what they have gone through over the span of years. I agree that they're, you know, I know some people really don't like the music in this movie. I could kind of go either way with it. I think the music is fine in the film. But when you go to a film festival, you have to review stuff afterwards. And I reviewed this for Screen International, and I, you know, went back home on the shuttle thinking about what I was going to write. And you know, this is one of those reviews I have to say where I always want to do my best and feel like I capture a movie, but this one felt important. It felt like, I hate using that word important, as you know, Will, I hate using that word to describe movies, but bearing witness is correct. This is a movie about, you need to listen to this. Like, you need to hear these stories. And I would also say, since I'm at a documentary festival, as subjects of a film, I think Safechuck and Robson are very compelling. I think they're very, beyond the story that they have to tell, them as individuals. What I think helps Dan Reed in this movie is that these two guys just inherently are interesting, complex characters. And so that adds another just sort of dramatic level to what's going on in the movie. I think this movie is really, really terrific.
Yeah, I'm glad it comes at it from the angle that it does, which is to say, we've touched this a little bit, it comes at from their angle. Like, this is not, like, obviously is, in many ways, is, I'll put it this way, if society had already decided that Michael Jackson was, what's the online terminology used, canceled?
He's canceled. He's problematic. He's canceled, yes.
If people were done with Michael Jackson, the way that they're done with Kevin Spacey, it would be a good example of it. I feel like this movie would be exactly as effective as it is. Like, this does not, one of the things that you see people, most of them have not seen it, have been like, well, it's out to get Michael Jackson, or these guys are trying to get money, or so on, so forth. Like, I feel like that is so disproven by just actually watching the film. The film is not a polemic against Michael Jackson. Don't get me wrong. There's a ton of horrible, horrible stuff about Michael Jackson in this movie, but it never feels like that's exactly what the point is. The last hour is really what the point is where it's going the entire time. And you're right, they're both so compelling. I think probably the fact that they're both both come from the world of entertainment and like are able to be kind of visually compelling, and they're able to tell stories in a way that's riveting. The movie has so many little moments that just, like, obviously there are moments that just are just like physically repulsive, but there are so many little moments that I think Wesley Morris, I think, touched on this in his piece. The moment where he goes, where Michael Jackson goes with Jimmy Safechuck and to buy a ring.
Yeah.
And he goes to buy a ring that's basically showed that they are like betrothed together. And Jimmy still has the ring. And when he goes in and Michael Jackson goes in there, he has them pretend that he's getting him for a woman. And it's just like you, and it's so like, you're just like, you fucker. You knew the entire goddamn time. Like, that, to me, that's really what this is about. How, I mean, listen, I got a 7-year-old, 4-year-old boy, man. It's one of the most powerful things that that Reed does when these guys are telling the stories is he focuses. I don't know if the movie's most inventive filmmaking, but he has this one technique that it works. He does it over and over and over, and it works every single time, which is when he is telling the stories of when they are telling the stories of what Michael Jackson did to them, he shows pictures of them that they were at the age where it happens. And that is, and there are times where you see the pain on Jimmy and Wade's faces, but there's nothing more powerful than to hear these stories. And the movie is just pictures of them as kids. It makes you want to throw something against the wall. Like, it makes you want to put your fist through the wall. And that is something that it's not just that what's happened to them, but how it's happened to them, and how, when you take a step back from it, this was the plan all along. This was, he was fishing, you know, in a way that's not different than R. Kelly. And it's just really, really upsetting to watch that. But I think that's why, but it never feels like misery porn. It never feels like you're just like, you, like this is something that you have to endure. I'm with you on the idea that it's important. There is important stuff here, that what they go through, and it's not just, it's leading up to something, and it's leading up to them still trying to work with this, and still trying to work through this, and still trying to resolve it in some ways successfully and some ways unsuccessfully, including their families. To me, I thought this movie was a terrific piece of just public information. And then in the last hour, it becomes something else. It becomes something even a little bit more powerful.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not an expert in a lot of these type of, you know, we want to call it tell-all sort of documentary expose type of things, but this movie has a narrative arc. It is actually thought through from beginning to end. There is a story being told. There is a beginning and a middle and a hell of an end to it. And I also think, in terms of quote-unquote importance in the movie, this to me sort of shatters the idea forever, if anybody still thinks this way, of, well, why didn't someone say something at the time? Or why are they only bringing up these stories now? Why didn't they bring them up at the time? The psychology of abuse survivors and what they go through, and how it takes them a long time to process what happened to them, and how it's not an immediate like, wait a second, this bad thing is happening to me right now, I need to do something about it. I think the movie also paints that really compellingly, so that I think viewers sort of understand that. I am very fortunate. I have not had that in my life, so I can't speak to it personally. But it's incredibly educational in how it works. It's funny that you mentioned the R. Kelly thing, Will, because at Sundance there was a documentary about Harvey Weinstein talking to several of the people that he allegedly abused. And I had a female colleague. These two movies played on the same day at Sundance, by the way. Michael Jackson was first, and then the Harvey Weinstein one was later in the day. And a female colleague of mine said, like, it's hard to watch any other movie about abuse survivors after watching the Michael Jackson one, because, listen, the people that Harvey Weinstein did the things that he did to, that's terrible. And what they went through is absolutely awful. So it's not to diminish what they went through. But after the Michael Jackson one, it's really hard to watch anything else, is what my colleague was telling me. And it's kind of true. Like, this is sort of like, if not because of his fame, because he was famous for so long. I also want to say, by the way, the Carl Wilson piece in Slate is really terrific. I haven't read the Wesley Morris piece yet, but Carl Wilson, I think, who's a pop music critic and has written about Michael Jackson in the past, he also, I think, has a really great piece about how you can't cancel Michael Jackson, and that's part of the problem, and maybe we shouldn't cancel Michael Jackson. It's a really, really fantastic piece. Capital One is currently doing a series of different commercials. One of them has a Prince song in it, and Prince is still fine as far as we know, but you know, Prince is dead. They also have one about with Michael Jackson in it, a Michael Jackson song. And that song and that commercial continues to play. I've heard it on Spotify. I hear it on television. And I saw this, I saw Leaving Neverland back in January. And I have been a lifelong Michael Jackson fan, and was very upset when he died, even at the time, you know, knowing the allegations against him. It is not necessarily the movie's job to make me not want to listen to Michael Jackson anymore. I think that's not the point. It's been really hard. And I think that is part of the power of the movie. And then the last thing I'll just close with for myself is that the point that you bring up, Will, about them bringing the Dan Reed bringing back the pictures, again, I think it's really effective. I totally agree. And also, you watch those, you look at those moments and you do not think, why were these people so dumb? Like you do not blame the victims. You look at Michael Jackson and think, how could you do this? And I think the other question that the movie doesn't get into, and I'm glad it does not, which is psychologically, was he damaged in some way? It does not try to explain the behavior. This is not a movie where we are doing a psychological X-ray of Michael Jackson. It's about these two guys. It's about their families. Yeah, there are filmic techniques in this movie that are traditional and conventional and like that. I just didn't care. I just found it such an emotionally overwhelming experience that I just – that didn't bother me.
All right. Well, we're not going to give this a grade because it's not officially in Dorkfest rankings. I think people get an idea of what we would give it. But certainly, I think everyone – I hope everyone got a chance to watch it this weekend. It's still on HBO Go. I'm curious. I would be curious at some point maybe to revisit and see what the ultimate reaction was about this. I certainly feel like the conversation leading up to the movie was a fascinating one. I'm curious to see how much this has changed and how much this really does change. Does this turn Michael Jackson into Kevin Spacey or does it not? I am fascinated to see what happens with that. All right, so that is Leaving Neverland, Grierson. I can't imagine what it was like. I saw that on a screener. I can't imagine what it was like to see it in a crowded theater in Sundance. It was... must have been intense.
For a lot of people, the bathroom break that you talked about, I have never had the experience of just like being in a long line for a bathroom and nobody talking or looking at each other. Like people just, I couldn't make eye contact with people. It was just too hard. And these are friends of mine and colleagues of mine, and we all just like couldn't talk. So yeah.
All right. Now we go to our second new movie of the week. It's a strange world where this is the second most disturbing movie that comes out in the world.
Yeah.
Poor Gaspar Noé, man. He's going to have to up his game. Don't do that, Gaspar. You've done enough. Our second new movie this week is Climax.
Ce qui ne me tue pas me rend plus forte.
Climax is a new movie from writer-director Gaspar Noé, who's done Enter the Void, and his last film was Love. And this is set in the mid-1990s and is supposedly somewhat based on a true story. Mostly, I think it was inspired by an incident that Gaspar Noé sort of took and made his own. It's a group of dancers in France in the mid-1990s. And as the movie begins, we meet all these dancers. Most of these are non-professionals, they're not actually actors. They are dancers. And the reason why they are dancers and not necessarily actors is because Gaspar Noé needs them to do some of the most amazing dancing in a recent film. As the movie begins, they are finishing a rehearsal, and they are all just, you know, unwinding and having a party at this abandoned schoolhouse. And we just get to meet all of the different dancers as they're talking about their lives, their sex lives, what they're thinking about, what they're kind of going through. And, you know, everybody's just sort of having a fun time. And then they discover that the sangria that they're drinking, someone has spiked it, and there is something happening to all of them, and things just get weirder and weirder and weirder and more violent and more ugly and more terrible. This movie premiered at Cannes last year, and I was at the first screening of it. I guess I'm a Gaspar Noé apologist. I think Enter the Void is fantastic. It made my top 10 that year. I actually liked Love quite a lot, and I really thought there was a lot of interesting stuff that Noé did in that movie. And I say all that to say it's weird to be a Gaspar Noé apologist who doesn't love Climax as much as a lot of people do. The joke has been for a lot of people who've interviewed him, including myself, I interviewed him for Mel Magazine, is that, you know, he's such a divisive figure. He's such a provocateur. And he's made a movie now that most people actually really like a lot. And it's a weird position for him to be in. And I think Climax is good. And I think there's a lot of really inventive, interesting things that are done in this movie. He is once again working with his cinematographer, whose name I'm going to botch right now, and I apologize. But Benad Dibi, that's the best I can do. There's a lot of really inventive camera work, and there's a lot of really fun experimenting that goes on as the night gets trippier and weirder and weirder. I don't think there is a lot underneath in terms of this movie, which I actually would argue with both Enter the Void and Love as two most recent films, that there actually was more kind of intellectually and emotionally going on. Climax, as Noé has said, is in a lot of ways inspired rather by disaster movies of the 1970s. And that's kind of what it is. It's sort of like a disaster horror movie type of thing. It feels like more of a fun exercise as opposed to something that he feels as deeply as some of his recent movies. Will made the point earlier about the characters in Russian Doll. I don't think the characters in this movie are characters I necessarily want to spend a lot of time with. And he's always made movies about sort of disreputable people, but I don't think they're as compelling. They're more fun kind of as a collective. That being said, if you're on this movie's wavelength, they're kind of at least sympathetic to the types of things that Noé does. This is a more sort of accessible mainstream kind of film from him. Also, it's shorter. His movies can be 2.5 hours long. This thing's only about 93 minutes, and it's about the right length, I think. There's still the fun visual stuff, the same kind of fun musical stuff that he does with song choices and like that. As usual, his credits are like nobody else's in the game right now. It's not a great movie. I think it's somewhat overrated, but I've seen it twice now. I saw it again recently, and it's a weird word to use with a movie that's this dark and this disturbing in a lot of ways, but it's fun in a way that I was able to kind of roll with.
Yeah, I have to say, I like it a little bit more than you. And it is fun. And I feel weird saying that considering some of the terrible things that happened in this movie, including a kid, there's a kid that gets involved in this movie. That is the one time where it felt like it was Gaspar Noé being like, okay, just to make sure you're not having too much fun. this is a guy who makes it, we didn't talk about Irreversible for crying out loud. It's maybe the most disturbing of all of his movies.
Yeah, his greatest hit, yes.
Yeah, and it does feel like there's a segment with a kid in this movie that honestly feels like him being like, I just want to make sure you're not enjoying yourself too much. It seems to exist solely for that reason. Otherwise, this thing is really enjoyable, and I'm sorry, I know dark things happen, I know terrible things happen, I know they go down the rabbit hole, but listen, there is a certain unreality to this movie from the get-go, starting with the fact that, like, I don't know, Gerson, I'm going to make a confession. I've never taken LSD. Back in college, I did some psilocybin mushrooms. But that's something entirely different. And I've never done LSD. I assume that this is like, if everybody I knew that had done LSD had this experience, they would either be dead or would have never had a second experience. Like this is LSD. Like the sangria is spiked, but it is spiked with movie crazy juice is really what it's spiked with. Like this is not like, I've read a couple reviews of this, a couple of negative reviews of this that were like this movie's like anti-drugs. Like, this movie is not about drugs. This movie is just about these dancers who, I think, one of the he's two very smart things from the very beginning. First, even though he does the, here's a shot to something later happening in the movie that we're starting with the movie with, just so you know, this thing is dark. We've complained about that a few times. But then there's like this long interview with all the dancers. They're kind of banal. They're kind of, some are nice, some are not nice, some are funny, some are not funny, some are experienced, some are new. We just get like a sense, it's almost like it reminds me of like a real world 90s-esque kind of a reality TV show kind of interview thing. And then we get to watch them dance. And he has talked before about he is into dance, and he, like, this is obviously something that he cares a lot about. There is, you touched on this a little bit, but there's some truly incredible dancing in this movie. Like, and in the beginning, there's such joy to performance and such, it's sexy, but it's really just like, it's these young, beautiful people doing amazing things that to start out with that, and say, okay, to like, this is before the cush hits, if you will, and then have everything kind of devolve after that. It is an experiment. This movie he's running with an experiment, and he's just saying, how far down the rabbit hole can we go with this? And it turns out, pretty far. You can go down the rabbit hole pretty far on this. But I did not at any point find this connected to reality in any way that I or anyone I know have ever experienced it, on drugs or otherwise, which is okay. That's totally fine, because you want this movie. This movie basically says, everything's going to go batshit, okay? Everything's going to go batshit. So are you along for the ride, or are you not along for the ride? To me, I was absolutely along for the ride on this thing. Again, I can't go all the way with it, because again, that there is a kid in the movie. I wouldn't use the term, but I am triggered by the bad things that happen to children. So like that's the when you introduce a kid, what's the old Chekhov line, right? Like the
Chekhov's gun. Yeah.
Yeah. When you introduce, it's not the gun. The gun was a variation of it. What Chekhov's thing was actually, when you introduce a kid at a party where everyone is on unwittingly on psychotropic drugs that are going to make everybody go crazy, that kid has to go off in the third act. That's it. I think the gun thing evolved out of that.
Yeah. He was, once again, proving he was a visionary. He saw the future of parties and drugs and substances and like that. In terms of, it's a mostly non-professional cast. Sophia Boutella, who's like basically the lead in the movie. She's the one, sort of one of two professional actresses in the movie. When I saw it at Cannes, that was the first time anybody had seen it. When the dance sequence, it's lengthy-ish, but when the dance sequence happened, I actually asked some colleagues who were there too. I thought, did you think that was going to be the whole movie? And then number two, did you think, I'm totally fine if this is the entire movie? Because there was a brief moment where I was like, maybe it's just going to be a whole dance thing. Yeah, the dance is, I did not mean to, underpraise it by saying it's some of the best dance sequences in recent years. They're great. They're fantastic. There's so much. And by the way, the music choices in those scenes are also really, really great. I think it, for me, it's not just what the whole kid subplot. There's also a couple other ones where it's sort of like, hey, is this the type of thing that would make you queasy? Well, guess what's going to happen? There's another couple things like that in the film. My understanding is that this was largely improvised, off an outline, that he didn't really have a script, and they just kind of went for it. They just shot over a few weeks, and he had sort of a general idea of what he wanted to have happen. When I interviewed him, he said that for inspiration, he showed the dancers, they did a compilation of of real videos of people at clubs like losing their minds because of different substances as a guide to say, okay, try this in terms of what how you act as you after your drinks are spiked. I mean, one of the things that's sort of interesting that he has brought up in interviews is this idea of, well, do we know how much of what is happening and the sort of psychotic behavior that they display, how much of that is the substances and how much of that is actually really them, which is sort of an interesting idea. I just don't think that the movies, I agree, it's not connected to reality, but I think the problem is that anything beyond the sort of sensory high of the movie, and the movie is a sensory, I mean, this is what he does. This is the type of thing he does really well. In terms of there being any sort of deeper meaning or feeling anything in terms of watching in terms of these characters, I'm a little more sort of suspect about that. And it has, I was really curious to watch it again to see if certain sequences held up as well as it did. But, you know, if there was a category for best turned upside down camera shots, this movie would easily win. There's a great, great, great sequence in terms of something that Gaspar Noé does. So, you know, as somebody who has liked his other movies, it's kind of fun to have a movie that people are actually really down with of his. To me, it's fun, but it's not much more than just fun.
Yeah, I will say, though, I do kind of, and I don't want to go too much, I don't want to give away the ending, though. It doesn't turn out that everybody goes to Disneyland. Like, it doesn't end in like a happy place. But I do like that there's almost a couple moments of like quiet grace a little bit. Like, it's kind of strange, right? Obviously, some things turn out poorly for some characters, but I do like that there's almost a little bit like in the end days, a couple characters find places to go to find warmth. And you never see that in a Gaspar Noé movie. It's an experiment. It is experiment, but it is a sensory thing. And I was down with it, man. I was totally down. It is ridiculous in a way that I found kind of irresistible. So, all right, Kristen, so what did you give it?
I give it a B.
I give it an A-. I am full A- on Climax. This is a good time. I had a grand old time with Climax. All right, so now we go to our final new movie of the week. Our final new movie of the week is Greta.
Where's this?
I have a bag that I found that I think belongs to Greta Hedegg.
Oh, bless your heart. Where did you find it?
On the subway.
Oh, would you like a cup of coffee? You've been so kind.
I don't get many visitors here. I've been so lonely since my daughter left.
Well, I could help you. My mom actually used to say, I'm like chewing gum. I tend to stick around.
Greta is the new movie from director Neil Jordan, who we discussed recently, who did Interview with a Vampire. Don't worry, Greta is better than Interview with a Vampire. It stars Chloe Grace Moretz as Frances, who, as the movie begins, has just moved to New York with her friend, played by It Follows star Micah Monroe. They live in New York. Frances is she's a good soul. Her best friend thinks she's a little bit naive and she may not be able to handle New York. But, you know, Frances, for all intents and purposes, is a pretty good egg.
Can I step in there real fast, by the way?
Do you think she's not a good egg, Will?
No, the movie plays her out like a good egg. They're like, wow, can you not handle New York? She's from Boston.
This is like, one of the, yeah, this is one. Hey, you want to talk about a movie that is existing in the land of unreality? Welcome to Greta. Yes, yeah,
I'm like, yes, wait, what? I'm like, oh, she must be from like suburban Topeka or something.
Right. Once again, more proof that we are just, you know, not giving Boston and its sports fans their props. You know, we underestimate them. Look what she can do. Look what Tom Brady can do.
You survive Boston. New York's going to be a breeze, man.
You're fine. So Frances is on the subway, you know, because you know that doesn't happen in Boston, and she finds a handbag that's been left there by somebody, and because she's a good Samaritan, she grabs the bag off the subway and she looks inside and she finds the address of this woman who must have left her bag on the subway. That woman's name is Greta, and she's played by Isabelle Huppert, recently of Elle. Fame and Things to Come fame. And she goes over to her house. Isabel is a lonely widow and she's really, really grateful that Frances has found her bag. She invites her in and they sort of spend some time together and they sort of see in each other a person that they are missing in their own life. Greta has a daughter, but Greta's daughter lives in Paris and never really talks to her. And Frances recently lost her mother. And in the Isabel Huppert character, she sees this sort of like loving mother figure that she doesn't have anymore in her own life. And so a friendship begins between the two of them. But without revealing too much, because I think part of this movie's charms is the twists and things that happen, Frances will quickly discover that this friendship has been orchestrated in a way that perhaps Frances did not in fact realize, and that there's something more sort of sinister and ominous going on with Greta. I reviewed this movie for us for Paste, and one of the things I talked about in my review is that this is, I feel like, the sort of movie that you come across, maybe three of them a year, where the idea of the movie is they keep telling you, but don't you get it? We're making fun of some of this stuff, and we're like, you know, really kind of camping it up, and we're like referencing these, you know, cinematic tropes, but kind of like in a fun, cheesy, knowing way. Isn't that fun? And I sit there watching the movie going, yeah, no, I get that. And like, aren't you having fun with that? I'm like, I'm having a decent time. Like, is that okay? Because to me, Greta is a movie that is never enough of any one thing to be good enough to recommend. There are parts of this that are like a Hitchcock thriller. There are parts of this that are sort of campy and fun. As somebody who occasionally on Saturday nights with his wife, if we have nothing else to do and we're just kind of like tired from the week, we'll turn on the Lifetime Movie Network and watch the original thrillers that they have on there, which tend to be, I am a young female character and I have a relationship with someone I trust, like a babysitter or a friend or a neighbor, and it turns out they're actually evil and look what happens. Greta is kind of in that world as well. So I get what is fun and I get what is enjoyable about Isabel Huppert going, and this is a technical cinematic term, so I apologize if this is sort of pretentious. She goes batshit crazy, and that's kind of the fun of a performance like this. Like, can you believe Isabel Huppert is doing this in a movie? And I go, yeah, I can believe that. That's not that crazy to me. I just don't think this movie is funny enough. I don't think it's fun enough. I don't think it's sharp enough. And I don't think that the things that are, again, kind of underpinning this movie are interesting enough for it to fully work. As I said at the beginning, this is much better than Interview with a Vampire, which we talked about, which was a total disaster. This movie, I think, has a lot of great elements, and there's a lot of really interesting things that are kind of going on in the movie. But it never, for me, got beyond the idea of this is an interesting conglomeration of a bunch of different stuff that never entirely comes together.
Yeah, you know, it is not one consistent thing. That's kind of the problem with Greta, is if it went full camp, kind of from the get-go, I'd have definitely been down. And there's a couple moments, I don't want to give too much away, but there's a moment involving Isabel Huppert, or Huppert, as I prefer to call her.
Chekhov's Huppert.
A French name in the first act will be mangled in the third act. So there's a moment involving Isabel Huppert and a needle that feels like, okay, this is what this freaking movie should have been from the get-go, right? And those scenes, anytime that she's going, as you so clinically put it, batshit crazy, and I appreciate for using the original Latin.
How else would one properly pronounce that? Yes.
That's when the movie goes appropriately nuts, and that's what the movie should be, and I wish the movie was a lot more of that. Can I say, I don't think Chloe Grace Moretz really knows what's going on in this movie. I think that she plays this so kind of dully, deadly straight, in a way that she's not a dull actress. She does lots of interesting things all the time, but for some reason, she's just decided to play this. And maybe she was trying to play off Huppert playing so big, but Huppert doesn't actually play big for a while. So Moretz is a very, very boring character. There's really nothing going on with her. In fact, her roommate, you talk about Megan Monroe, is a lot more interesting. I think ultimately to the point where you wondered if I'm curious. I know this is this got a wide release. I don't know if maybe this may have got fidgeted with a little bit at the end. That thought occurred to me a couple of times. But it's almost if like she's like so much more charismatic than Moretz is in this. They're like, you know, we need to give her a bigger part than just the usual side roommate character, because she brings a lot to this in a way that I don't think Moretz necessarily does. I just think she's maybe not on the right wavelength. And so, and maybe she's trying to, again, maybe she's trying to contrast with Huppert, but it doesn't really work. She's mostly just kind of boring. And that's a bummer because we have to spend a lot of time with her. There's a couple of nice little moments. There's one, kind of a side early on in the movie that ends up paying off in a way that's very entertaining. About when you discover what that aside was really about, that I kind of enjoyed. But yeah, it feels, again, it is better than an Interview with a Vampire, but it actually feels a little, there were times where I thought, you know, I like Neil Jordan. And if he's allowed to keep his consistent tone from beginning to end, I feel like he can really kind of cast that spell into the right thing. But when he's not, when he's trying to do something that's more mainstream entertaining or widely entertaining, he makes concessions that I think break the mode and just kind of destroy the whole deal. And I do. I really don't think, as much as I enjoy Huppert, she also goes crazy maybe a little bit too early in the movie. That's another problem, is you get halfway through the movie and you're like, okay, now where's this movie gonna go? And all it does is just goes more in that direction, but not in a climax sort of way where it just goes all the way to its logical extension. It just kind of keeps going. I wanted this to be nastier than what it was, or bitchier than what it was, or crazier than what it was, or more serious than what it was. It just becomes ends up being a little bit of everything, which is to say a lot bit of nothing.
I mean, speaking of Elle, which is a terrific movie that Huppert was in, I kept thinking, boy, if Verhoeven made this, it would have been great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I mean, the two filmmakers I thought of were Verhoeven and Olivier Assayas. Those are two guys who just kind of like, they go for it and they seem to have a certain ability to know the line and kind of walk it. And I mean, I think Neil Jordan co-wrote this, and it's from a story by Ray Wright, and they wrote the screenplay together. And it definitely feels like, I mean, I get the sense that this is what they wanted to make. I just feel like it feels too much. It feels too much like, wouldn't it be fun if we did something like this, as opposed to really kind of, it feels like a dabble, as opposed to really kind of like understanding it. I agree about Chloe Grace Moretz, and I also agree with you that I think that the strategy is she is supposed to play essentially the Little Red Riding Hood. You know, she's supposed to be the babe in the woods who doesn't know what she's getting herself into. The fact that they establish the fact that because she was from Boston, where nothing bad ever happens, she's not used to New York. I think they're supposed to set up the idea that she's supposed to be kind of a wallflower, kind of a, you know, she's supposed to be kind of timid. And so Chloe Grace Moretz plays it that way. But there's not enough like spark between the two of them. And so when Greta starts amping up the stakes, you don't feel like it's two combatants. It feels like one person is being really conniving and sinister, and the other one's just sort of like letting it happen to her. I mean, I think the thing that is, in terms of thematically, that's interesting about this movie, and it's not interesting enough, is the idea of women not being believed. And because she goes to the cops and that doesn't work, and people just don't in general kind of believe her. And there's a little bit of that that I think is kind of an interesting kind of commentary, but it's just not done well enough. Hey, Will, it's a Neil Jordan movie. Is Stephen Ray in this?
Yeah. What accent, by the way, Stephen Ray does in this movie?
Yeah, I mean, I know that a lot of this was actually shot in Dublin, and so it's got that thing. And this is not a problem for me. I don't care about this, but one of the complaints about this movie is that it's set in New York, but it's not actually shot in New York, so it doesn't look like New York. That part doesn't bother me. So that's not an issue for me. But you know, when Stephen Ray shows up in an important role, kind of maybe two-thirds of the way through the movie, I don't think that stuff is fun enough. It just feels it's a somewhat inspired idea, but not inspired enough to really kind of carry it all the way through. I think there is, and I'm not going to reveal this, but I think there's one sequence in this movie that's really well done. And it's kind of a surprise. And when it happens, I thought to myself, oh, and it felt like for a brief moment, the movie was ratcheting up to something else, a different type of movie. And then I realized it wasn't going to do that. And I was, once again, just kind of like just generally not hating the experience. Because there's a lot of this, I mean, again, it doesn't all work, but you don't necessarily know where it's going. So there's like an unpredictable feeling while watching the movie. But overall, it just, I couldn't get there. I mean, the GIFs for this film will be fun, and I'll be seeing them on my Twitter timeline for the next 5 years.
They're not GIFs, Grierson. They're GIFs. They're not GIFs. Don't ever. I will end this podcast permanently if you call them a GIF again.
See, this is so interesting because I call them GIFs for years, and I kept being told, no, no. My love about people with GIFs and GIFs, because listeners of this podcast know, we like discussing the pronunciation of words, but it was funny that for years, I feel like however you feel about the GIF-GIF controversy, you are very sure about that. I'm also more of a GIF guy myself, I have to say.
It's not more of a GIF. There is a GIF, and then there is the incorrect way of saying it.
Right. Listen, I don't control the culture, man. I'm just telling you.
I don't either.
I'm just telling you.
I just stick with facts, and it is GIF, and then the incorrect way to say it. Now move on.
A lot of anger at the end of this podcast.
No, it's not anger. It's the right way to say it and the wrong way to say it.
Okay.
Anyway, go ahead.
The GIFs for this movie
I will
be seeing on my timeline for the next 5 years.
I'm actually mad at you for nodding. This is,
yeah, like, but you're not. But you're not angry. That's the important thing.
I'm letting go. And also, it's not a. You didn't write a blog. You wrote a blog post.
Okay. What I love about that is you have to be old enough to know a time when such a thing was even a thing that people actually said, that there was an understanding of being confused about those two things. So as I was saying, yes. You know, these GIFs, they're already on my timeline on Twitter, but they will continue to be for years to come. And they will be amusing. Hey, Isabelle Huppert, like twirling in a circle. That's amusing. I chuckled at that during the movie, but it feels like that is all the film kind of is ultimately. So yeah
I'm kind of with you on this one. Okay, what'd you give it?
I gave it a C+.
I gave it a C. I couldn't quite go that far with it.
Yes. What do you give GIFs?
I don't know. I also don't give unicorns a grade because they don't exist either.
I'm imagining like the Leech household, you know, you're imparting wisdom to your children and saying like, you know, it's good to be a good person and have a good soul. Also, if you ever call it a GIF, I am kicking you out of this house. You're disbanded. You're thrown out of the place. You're a black sheep.
I'm still just trying to deny the existence of the internet to them. So
it's like a dog tooth situation over there. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
That's exactly what it is. That's an underrated context now for dog tooth. You're just trying to hide them from the internet.
When is the article going to be written when dog tooth gets right about parenting? Like, where is that? Where is that article?
I may write that piece.
You're welcome.
I'm just throwing planes, little toy planes. Oh, that one fell from the sky.
You like Rocky III, so that scans. That makes sense.
All right, Grierson, so that's the show. Enjoy the rest of True False. Have a good time. When you go, how long are you there? When do you leave?
I leave on Monday.
Oh, so this is your last day. We're taping.
This is my last day, yeah.
Yes, all right. Well, have a safe flight. But if you see my friend Matt Pitzer, future mayor of Columbia, Missouri, please tell him I said hello.
I will.
Otherwise, we got new movies coming up next week. We got one new movie, and it's a big one, as they say. And by that, I mean it has large images. That movie is Captain Marvel. That's right. It's time to return. Oh, when? I called you when. Grierson. I was yelling with Wynn all day yesterday. Grierson.
That's a first, I think. That's a first. Yeah. It was the whole GIF thing. You got back into the mindset of instructing your children in things.
You're not wrong. Grierson, are you ready to go back to this Marvel Cinematic Universe? Like, are you ready?
I feel like I never leave.
Yeah, it is. You can check it anytime you like. It is directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck. Stars Brie Larson as Carol Danvers, the titular Captain Marvel. Samuel Jackson, Ben Mendelsohn. Bidding is in this. Clark Gregg. Everyone looks younger because it's the 90s. Like,
is it the 90s or 80s? I actually don't know when it's set.
It's the 90s. It's totally the 90s. I think it's supposed to be 1995.
Oh.
1995. She falls into a blockbuster.
Is this the same So this, basically, this movie and Climax are happening at the same time, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, the same good. Cinematic
good.
Yeah.
Good.
Okay, so we will be discussing Captain Marvel. Everyone's talking about the Captain Marvel. They like the Captain. They like the Marvel. They like the Captain Marvel. Also, next week, hopefully, neither one of us has seen this yet, but we're both going to try to get screeners of it. We're going to hopefully talk about, if neither one of us sees it, it's going to be a short show next week. But we're going to try to see Gloria Bell, starring Julianne Moore, directed by Sebastian Lelio, who did A Fantastic Woman, and actually did this movie. Like 10 years ago, right? He's remaking it, but now it's now
not
it's
not
in
quite that long ago. Yeah, he did it in Chile and is doing an American remake of it, starring Julianne Moore. When I interviewed him for A Fantastic Woman, I said, "Hey, you know, there's a lot of good reasons to do an American remake, but I'm curious why you decided to do it for Gloria." And he said, "If Julianne Moore wants to make a movie with you, like, you make that movie." I'm like, yeah, that's all the logic I need. That makes total perfect sense. So yes, this is that was Gloria. This is Gloria Bell.
Well, now we finally know why Spielberg made The Lost World.
That's actually at the end. If you stay through the end credits of Gloria Bell, it connects to Jurassic Park Lost World that you were in.
It just ends with Thanos will be back.
Right. If you are unable to get a screener of this, this is what the conversation will be next week as well. We will just riff on what possibly Gloria Bell, what happens in that movie. Yeah.
And we have a reboot. We have a reboot, Grayson. Reboot, reboot. Our reboot movie is 1960s The Apartment. The Apartamento. I mixed like four languages there.
I appreciate you using the original Latin.
Thank you. Directed by Billy Wilder. Sorry, Jack Lemmon, Shirley MacLaine, Fred McMurray. This won Best Picture. We just wrote about this in our Best Picture rankings. Oh, did you guys notice we put Green Book in there? And we didn't have to go down very far. The Apartment. This will be exciting. When was the last time you saw The Apartment, Christian?
Last time I saw this, the Academy did a bunch of screenings of their Best Picture winners. So I want to say it was on the big screen. And I want to say it was maybe 2002, 2003. It's been a long time. I'm really looking forward to seeing this again.
Yeah, and the Best Picture, it came out in 1960. So it wasn't that long ago that you saw it in the Best Picture. But we are all just put drops in the ocean of time.
Children, we are all just drops in the vast ocean of time. Also, if you call those goddamn things gifs,
you are out of the house.
You're out of the will. You have to work for yourself to support yourself.
There's going to be nothing for them in the will. that's not really a threat.
just spending money hand over fist. Will?
Oh no, you. We've got plenty. It's just not going to them.
Right. All those Jeff Tweedy bobbleheads, they don't come cheap, my friends.
You know, you can get like other people in the band bobbleheads now. What's the drummer's name?
Was it Glenn Kachi? Yeah. Is that his name?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. They have like it's weird though. A bobblehead of a drummer without a drum set is just kind of weird looking. It just looks like he's just balancing sticks in the air.
I'm sorry, kids, you can't go to college. Would you like a commemorative bobblehead?
Yes, like a murder bobblehead. All right, Grayson, we'll be back next week with Captain Marvel, Gloria Bell, and the Apartamento. Grayson, have a great week. Have a safe trip back from True False, and I will talk to you next week.
Bye.
Bye.
This shouldn't work, but it does. It only works because of us. And should anyone say different, it wouldn't matter at all. This only works 'cause of us.